Hey, welcome to the forecast. I'm Hemming Nelson.
And I'm Brian Kessler.
And today we're talking with Kristen Grimm, who's the president of Spitfire Strategies. And she's got a lot to say about having organizations ask themselves some hard questions. Why are they doing this? How could they be doing it better? Brian, you said that she was potentially your favorite guest. Were you just blowing smoke up her ass, or is that
I'm challenging Colleen to come on and prove me wrong. That's it.
Colleen, come on back. This episode, like all the others, are sponsored by Charity Engine today. They bought us some wine. Sorry about that, guys. I know that might not go over well.
I don't
Charity
think they signed
Engine,
up
HQ,
for that.
Maybe whiskey would go over better. Do you want to do the tagline?
Yeah. If your CRM is driving you to drink, give Charity Engine a call.
And that's charityengine.net. And here's our conversation with Kristen. So, Kristen Grimm, I'm going to start at the beginning of your LinkedIn profile. Which, by
it's
the way,
it's up to date, I hope.
This may be the thinnest profile I've ever seen, especially from someone with your experience. Usually this is 4 or 5 pages long, but this is pretty much one line with no description of anything you've done except a fellowship at the Aspen Institute.
Very nice. Well, my fellowship is very important to me.
Apparently.
As
did someone
I think
write
fellowship
this for
should
you,
be in
or
society.
Did you write this?
Know you had a LinkedIn profile?
Interesting thing about being a PR chick, if I will, is that people really would prefer your PR people not be that well known. So people would really prefer that I talk about them. So you will see that I, in fact, talk about the Aspen Institute, who, in fact, has been one of my clients and currently hosts me as a fellow. So I am doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing as a PR person, which is throwing the attention to another organization. That was good spin. I hope you appreciated the spin I just put you through.
I think it's an excuse. I mean, the first part of your LinkedIn profile is when people say, hey, should we hire these Spitfire people? Who's this Kristen Grimm person? And they look at it and like, I don't know what she does.
Well, again, I do try and hide because I'm not sure I want to be hired. So I like to play really hard to get. And then if people are very persistent, then I will consider being hired from them. And you know what? We're 50 people, so clearly something is working about my LinkedIn profile.
You are doing that very well. You started the same time I did, and you're a lot bigger than I am.
Well, there you go. Well, that's mostly because my staff have very good LinkedIn profiles. Yeah. And happily, they hire them, and I am
it's
I just
very
can
clear
walk
that
around.
Your staff is much more talented than my staff.
Yeah, we're only going to hire people based on their LinkedIn profiles from now on. How many connections do you have?
I have a lot of connections. You cannot say that I do not have a lot of connections.
Was Fenton Communications your first job?
I was an intern. I graduated from college, and I was supposed to go to law school, and I did not at the very last minute. And my father said I was unemployable, which is perhaps true because I was an Irish history major because I was going to law school. So it
did
didn't
you
really
do
matter.
A semester in Cork? Or
I did not. I did go over there for one January, which was very cold.
Yeah.
But I took Gaelic. I took this very seriously. I was a very good Irish history major. And then I was supposed to be a lawyer. And then I wasn't going to law school. And so my dad was like, you better find a job. So I drove to D.C., which was about 6 hours from Massachusetts.
Massachusetts? Where in Massachusetts are you
from? I went to Smith College. Well, okay. I grew up in Florida, but I was at Smith College.
Okay. Well, being from Smith, you're not unemployable.
Totally unemployable from Smith, yeah.
Oh, no, I was going to say you're not. That's a very good school. So that at least it's preparation for thinking, right?
Yes. So I was hired, and I showed up at the doorstep of Fenton Communication. And they were just finishing up Nelson Mandela Stadium tour when he came here with his message of peace. And they were like, hey, are you good on the phone? And I thought they meant like to talk to boys. And like, I was very good on the phone. Like, I'd had a phone since I was 13. But they meant like to get the New York Times on the phone.
I see.
But oddly, same skill set.
So this is
going to romance the Times.
I learned to romance the Times.
This is the nuts and bolts of what communication is. This is like what the interns and the program assistants.
Yeah, this is back in the day before good old email. So I definitely did like the blast faxing.
Burrell's
there
clipping.
Was some typing. There was definitely clips that I had to like cut out and paste.
This is the first time I've ever heard the term blast faxing.
Blast faxing.
So are you sending out the fax with like a handwritten list of fax numbers and who they're going to? And just
you could program the fax machine to go to all of the assignment editors in Washington, D.C. So I would put my little press advisory in, and it would go to them. And I would see it on the other end. And I went over to the Wall Street Journal one day, and literally right under the fax machine that was being blast-faxed into, there was a trash can that they were just falling all into. And it was at that moment I thought, oh, I hope somebody invents something like the internet. And then they did.
You could just unplug the fax machine instead.
Yes, but they didn't. They wanted to say that, yes, we got it, and we did what we needed to do with it, I think was very important.
So what are the things – so obviously less changed since then, but are there some rules that you or some talents that you picked up along the way that in your early years that are kind of core principles today? Like you mentioned, being able to talk to people on the phone is probably still helpful.
Being able to talk to people on the phone is definitely still helpful. I think, you know, one thing that has always remained, if you are a public interest group trying to use communications, is that there is always a lot already going on and you have to find a way to ride those waves. You know, this idea that you're going to be a small nonprofit or, hell, a big nonprofit, and you're going to define the news or set the agenda, like, sometimes, and that's great. But most of the time, you're really just trying to figure out, how do I jump on it? So it used to be that it was a slower news cycle, or it used to be that there was nothing online at all, and now everything is just faster and there's more. But it's the same thing, which is to say, what do we know the conversations are going to be about? Like, we know right now what the conversations are in America. They're about guns, or they're about terrorism. Mm-hmm. And the question is, can you relate your issues to those? Can you relate your issues to Paris and climate change? And how can you use that to shape debates and have conversations you need to have? So that is just a skill that, as you can learn that, that is how you can be a public interest group and actually make the world better.
Now that was on message.
How about that? Woo! That on the LinkedIn.
That came out easy, too. Mm-hmm. There was no ums or catchwords.
I said that a couple times before. And then you eventually left there after 4 years, and you went – I guess you started off on your own under the Spitfire brand, but working for Youth Vote?
Oh, no.
No?
I was at Fenton for 4 years.
Okay.
And then I left to go to the Millennium Communications Group for 3 years, and then I went back to Fenton, and I became their president.
Wow.
So I was their intern, and then I was their president over a number of years.
You were still in your 20s?
Yes. So when I was 28 – when I was 28, I became the head of Fenton.
And what did your father say about that?
My father would say, if we called him right now, it is not too late to go to law school.
Fenton might take you back if you ask nicely.
Yes. So, yes. So
is your father a lawyer?
Yes. Of course my father is a lawyer.
Okay.
So, yes. Then I went out on my own and started Spitfire in 2002.
Okay. And why didn't you stay at Fenton? They obviously liked you.
Yes. No, I really loved Fenton in a lot of ways. They had an amazing client list. I have many people who work here for me now who came out of Fenton. Really great staff. But, you know, at some point I sort of could run the company. And then it was like, well, why don't I run this exactly the way I want, like rather than the person who owned Fenton Communications. And so I did.
What were some of the things that you wanted to do differently? Not to say that they were doing it poorly, but that you thought you could do.
Two major things. One is just that it really matters who your people are and how to take care of your people. So I was really big on trying to create a place that people would love to come to work and that they would be treated incredibly well. And so that was really important to me. And secondly, I was very big on capacity building. So in the nonprofit world, a lot of times, and certainly at that time, everybody would sort of outsource their communication. There was just sort of this sense that people didn't really communicate, but they eventually might hire a media firm. And actually, as you all know, that now that everybody has to communicate 24/7, actually organizations have to become communicating organizations. And so suddenly actually knowing how to do your own communication strategy and being able to do tactics very well internally was super important. And so I founded Spitfire to mostly do capacity building because I wanted to help nonprofits learn how to do it for themselves. And other firms told me that I would lose my shirt if I taught everybody how to do it themselves and they would never hire me again. But yet here I am, totally hired all the time. Even with a poor LinkedIn profile.
So how do you make that argument though? I mean, you know, someone's like, hey, important issue, big campaign, we got to hire a firm, and then you're like, oh, you know what, hire me, and over the course of 6 months, we can train your staff to do that. Like that's a harder sell because you're changing their organization or you're asking that they make investments in personnel that's long term.
Mm-hmm. Well, they tend to do it actually differently. So mostly foundations will hire us for their key grantees that they want to make sure that they're improving their capacity. So a lot of times we are, okay, though, kind of training wheels. Like they might have a big campaign going on and we will come in and they will understand that we are there as arms and legs, but we are also there so that when we leave them, they actually will do a much, much, much better job. So like right now on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, we have been working with the Alaska Wilderness League, who is an incredibly brilliant staff, and they are really great, especially in Alaska and up on the hill, but they just haven't done a lot with social media. But our digital people have been really working with them, helping them build their list, helping them learn how to have a different pace and structure to the social media campaigns. And what's great about it is at the end of 6 months, when they don't have all this extra consultant money, they're actually going to be left a much stronger organization who will continue to be able to use this very affordable tool in very sophisticated ways. And so sometimes people just send people in for training, like we just trained up a bunch of folks working on nukes, which seems particularly important right now to have, you know, people who are containing nukes. Containing nukes. And it's really important because that's an issue that weirdly has gone away. Like when you think about,
you never hear about that.
Like Greenpeace started on nukes, and you will never. All they talk about is climate. But you think about it, like climate change is very dangerous. I'm not saying it's not. We should totally be focused on it. It's actually a little further ahead. There are thousands of unsecured warheads out there that could be a nuclear incident tomorrow. And you're sort of like, somebody should get
polar
on that.
Polar bears are much more appealing than warheads.
Totally more appealing.
We have a client, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists that does the midnight clock. Mm-hmm.
That's the doomsday clock for those that know it at home.
We just videotape there every year when they change the clock.
Yes.
We go and retape it.
Brilliant.
But, you know, they're like, you think about that group and you're like, oh, geez, they're kind of like relics. I mean, it's like 60-year-old men with ponytails and beards who are, you know, talking about Armageddon. And you're like, hey, dude, that was the 60s.
Except that you sort of look ahead and you think, like, those people who stand really strong, like, you look at the notorious RBG, you know? And, like, who would ever think, like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the total rock star she is on the Supreme Court? But you got to give that to that woman. Like, she's really a person standing between us and an abyss. So.
So you had this idea of building capacity. How did that go? Did that take a while to catch on, or was it, like,
wildfire? No.
How'd you build your own capacity?
So I started first and foremost by hiring a managing director, and at the time I had no one to manage. There was just me and now a managing director because I only wanted to work on clients.
That's pure overhead?
It's like pure overhead, but I was like, as we hire staff, like, I just don't want to deal, you know, with the handbook or the she's being mean to me. Like, I just want to do the client stuff. But I want the staff to be really well taken care of.
When you're a Fenton, that was what you were doing, wasn't it? The handbook and the...
I did a lot of, you know, operations, like a lot of making it all work, the magic behind the scenes. So I was sort of like, I just want to do the great client work. And Gwen, who's my right hand to this day, 14 years later, is like, she is great with staff. She is perfect. So I hired a managing director. And then the very first thing I did is something that Spitfire is famous for, because we're famous. Probably didn't see that on my LinkedIn, but we are famous for the smart chart. So the Packard Foundation hired me, and they were like, hey, we'd really like you to teach our grantees how to do communication planning. And I was like, oh, no problem. Like, take me two shakes. And 9 months later, I actually was able to sort of say, okay, this is the algorithm in a communicator's head that actually allows you to have a communication plan. And it was called the Smart Chart, and it's now in version 3.0. But thousands of groups use it. It's in many languages around the world. And what it basically just tried to do was demystify, if you ask these questions, you can't help yourself but have a communication strategy. And people use it all the time.
And is this a decision matrix? Like, you follow down, you go yes, no, and then you get down and it says, congratulations, you're
campaign. It says hire Spitfire, exactly. That's the fun part about it.
Campaign successful.
It doesn't run you into a yes, no. It's more like, you know, what's your objective? What climate are you operating in? Who are your audience targets? And if you write down good stuff, you will end up with a very focused communication strategy that's compelling,
and
which
that help,
everybody needs.
I assume that informs all of your work here internally, huh?
Totally, all of our work. So we're
helped
big.
You kind of think through, like, what your internal process was.
Yep, and we're big planners, and yep. And we like to have a good strategy. So we just think that's really important before you go out and do all that tactical stuff, which is super interesting. But I think I've seen tons of people spending lots of time on tactics that are just completely off the mark because, oh, wait, we were supposed to be, you know, influencing these audiences over here who, by the way, don't pay any attention to that vehicle or channel you just spent a lot of time
on. Can you give us an example of a campaign that went horribly awry by focusing on tactics that...
that went horribly awry. Well... there's so many campaigns that went horribly awry. I would say the biggest, though, is that, you know, people are always wanting to do something up on the hill. And so I have a group who, you know, just really wanted to do a health fair up on the hill.
They want to knock on doors, or they just want to rent out a congressional hearing room and have,
and then
like
do
a
like a big
party.
Event. And in this case, they wanted to do a health fair. Like, they just really wanted to do a health fair. And, you know, and you look at that and you're like – and you ask them, like, what are you working on? And they're like, child obesity. And then you realize, like, they're at the wrong place. Like, we don't do a lot of child obesity actually at the federal level. Like, we don't do a lot of school lunch. Like, yes, there was a big fight about whether ketchup was a vegetable or not. But really, largely, there's very local decisions. So, you know, they're just here kind of trying to get press or trying to, like, get the buzz going on social media. And what they're not doing is really thinking about, like, who's making these decisions and am I influencing them? So a lot of times you just find people in, like, the completely wrong place trying to influence the wrong people. Or you see them doing it at the wrong time. Like, a lot of times you see people doing a big push for something. You know, my least favorite is, like, people are driving down the road and you look up and there's a billboard and it says text to this number. And it's only funny if it's actually something about that's anti-text and driving, which only would make it funnier. But like you see that stuff where like that's just the wrong tactic. Like someone's not in front of their computer. Like that's a much better thing to look at drive time radio because they're listening to the radio. So you just see people all the time a little out of whack and you're like, you know, it would improve your results if you align to what your audience is doing. What is their life like?
So the first question in the smart chart is who are you trying to influence or what you're trying to accomplish?
What are you trying to get done? Yeah.
What are you trying to get done?
Absolutely. What are you trying to get done? Because you have to know what you're trying to get done. And I always tell people they can't just say raise awareness. My least favorite answer in that box.
To everybody.
That's to it. Everybody. Raise awareness among the general public.
Well, you know, mother, it's like two or three specific audience groups and then everybody.
Yes.
It's always everybody.
Always everybody.
Every RFP, 95% of the RFPs we respond to. Yes, they basically want to convert 90% of the population.
Who's this website for? Children under 12 and senior citizens and everybody in between.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Got it.
So how do you convince them that they shouldn't broadcast to everybody, but they should narrowcast and they should take some risks?
Yeah. Well, I make them I tell a funny story. Shall I tell you my funny story? I say,
is it funny after you've told it five different ways?
I think it's still pretty funny, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes with you two. You've not heard it. I've told it a few times, so I'm not going to lie about that. But I tell people that they should never target the general public, and I'm going to tell you why. My name is Kristen.
Hello, Kristen.
I am short. I prefer petite, though. I'm urban, and I'm educated. So, Hemming, three things about yourself.
I'm tall, and I'm urban, and I'm mildly educated.
Mildly educated. Three things about yourself, fine sir.
You don't remember my name, do you?
I don't even remember your name. Andy?
But it's Brian.
His name's not important.
I'm white, I'm male, and I like long walks on the beach.
Mm.
I'll give you an interesting fact about Brian. He's a former Marine.
And a former Marine. You would not expect this from this haircut. You would not expect it from this haircut.
And the flannel shirt.
So here's the funny ending to my story, that we could ask everybody in this building and we could ask everybody in town, and if I ask you to please describe yourself, not one person is going to say, I'm the general public. So it's so unfortunate if you're targeting them because nobody actually is part of them.
Okay.
How's that funny?
People just laugh uproariously, you know, whatever.
Probably because they're seeing like the hundreds of thousands of dollars they've wasted on being sold.
Maybe it's crying and I just thought it was laughing. It's like, maybe.
It's like when you stub your toe and you just like you can't cry, so you just laugh. That's it.
So do you do profiles? Do you build profiles of the people they're trying to reach? Or I guess no. First, we're still talking about what are you trying to accomplish?
What are you trying to accomplish? You're just all about the audience. Like you're not thinking about what am I trying to accomplish? Then you have to think about, well, what do I have to work with to accomplish that? So we actually make them do an internal scan, which helps you also not go after everybody because you remind yourself that, oh, I'm a 10-person shop. Like, what is your reach? Like, let's think about that before we start to think about how many people we're going to go after. And we ask them to think about externally, like, is your issue hot? Is your issue totally on life support? Like, what's going on with it? You know, how hard is this going to be?
How often is this a sobering process for your clients where they realize maybe their strategy for the last 2-3 years was generally in the wrong direction, and that's why they weren't seeing progress?
I don't think it's so much sobering. I think that's an interesting word. I'm thinking about it. I don't think it's so much sobering. I think for a lot of these groups, they're real issue experts, and just no one's ever said, let me show you the marketing brain. And as soon as you show it and they apply it, they're like, oh my gosh, you know, we could be doing so many amazing things, and I totally get this, and we're going to be so much better. So I find it, they seem to be very empowered. They always leave there with just chock full of ideas. They are, you know, they're very self-reflective that they haven't been effective, but these people are so passionate and mission-driven that they're like, this is so great that we have figured out that these are the folks to focus on, because now we realize we have a domino strategy and we need to get these three audiences going, and then all these other audiences are going to follow, and it's going to be nirvana. I mean, all these people are so committed to making progress on their issues that I don't find that they are beating themselves up. I feel more they're like, finally, someone just said, answer these questions in this order and you get this strategy. Like, all they want is to be more strategic with their money. And this is all free. This is just thinking. So for them, it's a real boon because these folks are, you know, these are the people having to go out against very moneyed interests. The only way they're going to win is to outsmart them. It's the only way. So they just love finding a way to think about it.
You've got to be involving the president or the CEO or whatever in these conversations, right?
Mm-hmm.
A common problem we get is, you know, if we're dealing with the director of communications, you know, we get the RFP to do the creative to support the campaign. And the campaign may or may not be misguided. But by the time we get it, that's what we're doing. And that person doesn't have the ability to say, like, hey, let's rethink this.
Right.
You know, the ball's already rolling down the hill. So I would imagine it's important when you start off these things to get decision makers buy-in.
Absolutely.
So is that a prerequisite? You're like, hey, we got to have these people at the table?
Yeah, we're pretty big. And in our capacity building trainings, we almost always have two people from any organization, and that includes an executive as well as a communication person. And that is because a lot of times you are making programmatic or organizational decisions. Mm-hmm. And then when we just run big campaigns, we always involve executive level. And that's, again, so that everybody understands what the buy-in is. I find, you know, a lot of communication officers just unbelievably brilliant. It is true that by the time they go up to their executives, when their executives aren't thinking about it, they're just thinking eyeballs or buzz or these things, which are exciting, but they don't necessarily mean results or progress. They just mean noise. And so really getting everybody bought into the strategy, which sometimes can get quite narrow, is super important. So executives, very important.
Well, so this reminds me of you were asking about what our favorite podcasts were earlier, and my favorite still is our interview with Colleen Hutchins, who was in the process of moving from environmental
perhaps working
group.
Perhaps our drunkest guest.
Also, yeah. She was going out to dinner with her,
there's a correlation there
afterwards. But moving from environmental working group, being their, I believe, director of communications to H&R?
Agency.
Yeah. There are a lot of agencies in D.C. But one of the conversations we had, though, was around how the organization for a long time had been driven by vanity metrics. So page views, email opens.
Exactly.
And suddenly, you know, if you really get down to it and start having a strategy, suddenly that's not eyeballs. That's not necessarily conversions. It's not meaningful interactions with yep. your brand or your message. And we spent a while talking about how they shifted that conversation internally and got buy-in. And one of the problems she brought up that I really hadn't thought of previously was that actually funders were for years being sold on these vanity metrics, and suddenly to come back with a new metric that was, you know, quantitatively lower. They talked about having to kind of almost have like an internal campaign to shift the thought process onto these new metrics. But it wasn't just staff. It was actually the major donors, the
yes.
grant providers as well.
Yeah.
And that was, I think that was, yeah, one of the kind of best takeaways, because that's a transition that every organization can benefit from.
Yes. Well, and going back to when I first started out, it used to be all earned media. And what you were mm-hmm. just looking for was how many clips did you get? Didn't matter if it was on message. Didn't matter if it actually, because somebody read it or saw it, that they actually did something different or called you in for a meeting. It was just straight up if you got the clip. And it also creates incredible competitiveness among issue groups. So instead of thinking about, well, who's the very best person to be doing this, you had to do it yourself because you needed the vanity metrics. And so it actually disincentivizes collaboration, which of course funders more than anything want the fields to be collaborating.
Well, that's interesting. Talk about that for a second. So this idea of traditionally a competitive group, maybe your topic is, you know, your issue is fracking and the pipeline was a hot topic in 2015. So suddenly you're saying necessarily it doesn't have to be someone from your group. You could have another fracking promote another fracking organization to help.
Right, but it depends on what your metrics are. If your vanity metrics about, well, how many people are following you on Twitter, then suddenly if I'm the Sierra Club with a massive list, I may not be sharing with a smaller group, even though really I should. Like maybe it's a really important thing. Maybe actually building their list and getting more locals involved would strategically be very important. But if one of the things my funders are measuring me on is my own reach and the numbers of my followers, as opposed to, you know, what I actually got a bunch of local groups really involved and we helped intensify the local opposition to this, you know, that's definitely more important. And I would just say that funders sometimes end up And I don't think they do this on purpose. Funders themselves are all trying to figure out these communication tools. But they do – they're just trying to figure out, well, how can I measure communications? Communications are so hard to measure. So – and it's easy, especially digitally. I mean, the analytics are, you know, nice to get to see. But you think about groups. Some groups have unbelievable spokespeople, and they should be the ones tweeting and the ones and doing our meeting. Other people should be the researchers. Mm-hmm. But suddenly you're making researchers have to have a Twitter following because that's how you're measuring communications. And it's like, well, is that – maybe – maybe, who knows? Maybe they're, you know, secretly incredibly good at that. But you really want to make sure that your grantees in the communication sense are leaning into their strengths and not feeling like I have to do stuff just to put the communication metrics on the board.
I think one of the other things that I've been exposed to since moving to DC is it sounds like you've had a steady career. Like you've actually served at some places for
Brian, are you saying you have not had a steady career?
I actually have. You know, I end up staying about 3 to 4 years at most places I work. But what I've seen in D.C., is, especially in nonprofits, is people come to D.C. to build their nonprofit career. And what that usually means is working their ranks very quickly through the organization, going to another organization to get that title bump. And then maybe 10 years down the road, they're going to, you know, move back to Montana or something. But I feel like that has a side effect where subconsciously you start putting short-term, I don't want to say improvements, but short-term goals ahead of kind of the big, broader mission. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about, you know, our metrics versus their metrics versus coalitions and partnerships. If you're career-driven, you might not realize it, but you might be susceptible to you know, worrying more about your Facebook count because that's what's going to look good the next time you're applying for a job elsewhere. Are the organizations you're working with, you know, offhand, does it sound like the people that are there have been with the organization longer? Mm-hmm. Or do you also have a mix of organizations where there does seem to be higher turnover, yet they're still interested in actually approaching a more holistic strategy?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I would go back to the executives and sort of who's in charge because I think that you're right. I think in the people underneath, you might have a lot of turnover. So the question is, do people understand? And, you know, you look at somebody like a Heather McGee from Demos, who is, you know, probably one of the best nonprofit leaders we have. She grew up at Demos. So Demos is a think tank, an action tank think tank, and they do a lot around income inequality. Done really some phenomenal work. And Heather's now the head of it, and she grew up there, you know, so she grew up among it. But she's, you know, she's taken a very long view of understanding the conversations that are going to have to happen over many years to get to a place where we're going to have better income equality. And so you really need that steady hand to understand that, you know, first we have to make it about this, then we have to move it to here. And for sure, those short-termers, and short-timers could be anywhere from 3 to 4 years. I mean, it's hard to move conversations in society very dramatically. I mean, you look at climate change now and you think, thank God, we're finally at a meeting where we're talking about how to deal with climate versus if climate exists. But, I mean, that's a relatively new phenomenon.
Well, it's still a conversation, which is also incredible.
Right. But finally, like when AP comes out and says, you know what, we're actually not any longer going to just automatically include both sides of this. The science is in. You are climate deniers. Like, that's a big moment in society, right? But you think about the slog, like the many, many, many years where we had to pretend like our science was equal to their science. Right. And so you need leaders who are taking, you know, 10, 20 year views when you're talking about these societal, sweeping societal shifts. So I think you're right. It has to happen at the executive level because I don't know that it's happening. Although I will say among the nonprofit world, they tend to stay nonprofit and they tend to stay in their issue. So while they might move up, you have, you know, Planned Parenthood goes over to NARAL, goes over to, you know, Population Action International. So you're still in reproductive health. So one thing I will say is that the nice thing is, we don't have a ton of people kind of leaving the nonprofit sector and going into the corporate sector, and we've lost them.
But does that create a problem for you because you're building capacity and then those resources then are gone?
Well, they tend to hire us at the new place. So, no, I mean, actually,
it's more work for you. Yes, you get a 20-year retainer.
Besides my mercenary take on that. Besides my mercenary take, actually, funders, one of the reasons when they – so we run an executive training program every year, and you can put executives in. It's a year-long – it really is to teach you how to run a communicating organization. But one thing we say is you should pick people who whether or not they stay at this organization, you think they are going to be a leader in this field, because you don't want to feel like if they came here for a year and then they left next year, that you'd be sad, but more like, well, I know that this person's going to stay within this issue set and it's worthwhile to make them an unbelievably great communication leader.
I think you look at a lot of businesses and organizations, though, and there tends to be that core, that cadre that is there from the start. You're talking about your the first woman you hired who's been here, what is it?
See, now you forgot her name, 13 Brian.
Years. She's Gwen. Not in the room.
Gwen.
I was just thinking Gwen. And she's still with you. Do you have some of your – any of your other original staff or from that those first couple of years?
Jill Greenberg's gone.
Jill Greenberg is gone. It's sad. She's in South Africa, though. Yeah. I – probably my longest-serving staff person right now, and we are – so we are 13 years old. I think I said 14 before. But we are 13 years old, and probably my longest term is 10, and I think she just walked out. Her name is Monisha, so she is probably the longest-serving other than Gwen. So Gwen and me, and then
– 10 years is a long time.
I have a lot of 10-year and 9 years. Yeah, no, it does feel a little bit like a very long-term relationship, so yeah.
So they have to have like a you have to have like an executive meeting to fire anybody who's been here after 10 years.
That should probably be. I was thinking more a sabbatical program would be nice for them, because if you stayed for 10 years, you should probably get a few months off. But
that would be incredible.
Do you deal with capacity in an organization that, where, as Brian discussed earlier, you know, you've got millennials who feel like they've been somewhere 2 years and they're getting itchy?
I have a Twitter account. I'm a social media expert.
Yes, that's right. You could come work here. you know, we have taken we are trying to make sure that we are modernizing Spitfire's workplace of, you know, flex time and you can work anywhere. We now, it used to be like you could work for us and then if life circumstance took you somewhere, you could we'd keep you. But now, like, we've just started hiring people in various different cities. So we have Raleigh and we have Denver and we have Richmond and we have all these different places where people are, just because that's where the talent is. Mm-hmm. But also, I don't necessarily assume, like, as the millennials come in, I do think that they do like to go do dramatically different things. And so, you know, we try and create a path, but also I understand that some people are just like, I just want to go do something completely different. And they don't tend to leave me and go to another firm. They're more like, I'm leaving and I'm going to play in a mariachi band in Mexico. And, like, all I can have is respect for that, really.
So. Do you want to line up that we were doing some work? I mean, all I saw was over Teague's shoulder, her looking through this PowerPoint, and I was enamored with it. I was like, I don't know what the heck this is about. But
it's awesome. Wasn't it awesome?
It looks awesome. Like, I want to know what the presentation is, because I like the PowerPoint.
Well, going back to so you were asking me about people moving around, and I said executive directors have to take the long view. And so the reason I was working with Foresight on this presentation is that people always ask me, like, people, especially in the nonprofit world, they tend to have theories of change. So they want some change to happen. But what you realize is underneath the theory of change, there has to be a theory of influence. Like, in order for that change to happen, actually, these people are going
to
have to.
Do they come to you with a theory of change, or do they come to you with what the change should result in?
Like, they come with a theory of change. They really do come and say, like, we want this theory of change. But, you know, it is very programmatic generally. You know, like, again, with the nukes people, it's, well, we want to reduce the actual arsenal. We want to secure the nukes that are out there. And we want the Pentagon to quit funding more nuke stuff. Like, that would make us a nuclear-free future. Like, that's your theory of change. So these three things need to happen. But then suddenly you're like, okay, so how does that happen? So just alone, especially when you have ISIS doing what they're doing, the idea that we are going to reduce our nuclear arsenal is one of those things where, like, wow, that's really hard. So what I did with your help is that I tried to come up with, you know, there's going to be a path and it is not going to be a straight path. And that's the most important thing to understand, is you are not going to say, this is a problem, this is the solution, so give me money. Like, that is not how the influence is going to happen ever, and certainly not here in Washington, D.C. So my point was to try and help people understand you're going to go on this crazy, windy path, and there are going to be certain lands you go through on this quest that are going to be crazy making. Like, you are not going to believe you have to do this. Because, like, you would wish that as a social justice group or organization, you would hope that people would just understand this is information. We've been decimating our urban areas by incarcerating everyone. And you would hope that everybody would be like, yes, we should stop that. But no, they're like, well, what do you mean by that? Well, maybe they deserve to go to prison. Well, maybe we should send more people to prison. And you're like, am I having a crazy conversation? Yes, I am. So
it's Thanksgiving. That was my Thanksgiving visit. There, no, I'm teasing.
There were probably many Thanksgivings
I love
like
you
that.
All.
Sorry. Brian, sorry he said that. So this presentation, though, tried to say, hey, try and anticipate that rather than thinking everybody's rational and you're just going to share information and they're going to accept it and everybody's going to be great, think instead of how they're going to react and what their brain's going to do to it and all the excuses and all the everything. And that will actually help you come up with the theory of influence. And so I came up with this quest idea because you guys said, let's make it a quest. And that sounded fun. And then I actually showed it to a group, and it was really amazing, kind of like the smart chart, which is like as you just tell people, like, think about this stuff, and then they do. You know, people have so much knowledge about the issues they work on that when you start to say, hey, instead of thinking of a straight path, think of a crazy windy one.
Whoops, that's me. Keep talking.
Instead of thinking of a crazy windy, you know, instead think about this crazy windy one, and then you're actually going to come up with what you have to do. And that's going to get you to the end. That's actually going to get you to where you want to be, which is like when you look at gay marriage, that's exactly what happened, was they looked at, let's put this, but remember that everybody out there is homophobic, and now play. Like, yeah. Okay.
And I think the people's own experiences, though, reinforce that windy path. And, you know, I've been on the grounds organizer for many years for other organizations, and The scary thing is if it is a straight path, then it's a straight path to undo it, right? If it's a windy path, then quite often it's earned. Mm. It's harder to turn that train around.
I like that.
So, it you know, don't fear the windy path. It's going to be very hard to undo gay marriage in the United States.
That's right.
It took a long time to get there, but the country has reached a fever pitch of buy-in, interest in – and yes. Outrage with you know, people that stood in the way of that, and it was state by state, and you just saw it, right? It wasn't steady; it was exponential. Like but once that first crack.
Do you think that was the result of a successfully planned campaign by a group of nonprofits, or do you think that is something that is happening regardless, and it was just a wave that overtook circumstances and the best of intentions?
Yeah. No, I mean, they have tons. I mean, they've done so much debriefing on this. And while certainly success has a million mothers, you know, you look at people like the Gill Foundation who said, we're going after marriage. Because the truth is, like, to have equality for people who are, you know, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, everything, like, that's a lot of stuff. It's not just gay marriage, but they really used gay marriage very symbolically. And they knew, and they put up ballot initiative after ballot initiative and knew, like, what were strategic losses, how to keep going. I mean, you look at the stuff that they anticipated and did. And what the thing was that they always knew, it's almost like a good game of pool, right? They always knew where that white ball leave was going to be, and they could hit the next one. Dude. And that's so smart.
My buddy's dad used to always tell us that a good pool player is a sign of a misspent youth. So are you a proficient pool player?
I am an okay pool player. I guess I had a little bit of a misspent youth. It's true.
We'll get to have that. A Buffalo Billiards meetup.
We'll get to that later. That's right. But knowing that the road is windy, well, it sounds like what you're saying is that you know, there was a lot of good work behind that, which could potentially be credited for that work. But knowing that it's windy, you know, my reaction would be, well, then how do you plan anything you have to sort of have an ideal and you work for it and then you deal with circumstances as they come. But how can you plan for something being windy?
Yeah. I think one is just knowing it's going to be windy as opposed to this is going to be a straight shot.
It just prepares you. When there's hiccups.
Well, and also it says to you, like, I'm going to decide where to make the curves, right? So instead of waiting and saying, well, I'm going to wait till it comes at me and then it's going to be adversarial, I'm actually going to create it myself. So thinking a little bit about, like, you know, net neutrality is a great example where we knew as we came out and said, we're going to make this a law that you have to create all internet traffic equally. Like, the corporations are going to go apeshit. Like, that's not a question. So it wasn't like, well,
it's like saying, I used cocaine in my youth.
Exactly.
Well, some corporations, though, I think that was the surprising thing about net neutrality was, I mean, for a company like Netflix and, you know, YouTube is owned by Google, who command, I think, like 40% of all internet traffic, they obviously are in favor of net neutrality. So it was – net neutrality to me was a weird one because it was the first time – in recent memory, I saw major, you know, multi-billion-dollar international corporations backing, you know, the side I was on.
But keep in mind that that didn't just happen by magic, because the truth is now Netflix itself, because it's successful, could have paid for the fast lanes.
Well, they have. They've cut deals with...
Right, but to get them to come out publicly on the side of, hey, the way you were able to disrupt was that you had an open internet, mm-hmm. is to remind them that this is part of your DNA of your company. And like, there are a lot of advocates that had to work for that really hard. You know, there were a lot of advocates that had to work very hard for civil rights groups who, you know, AT&T and the cable companies have very strong ties to. They do a lot of stuff in the community with them. But to remind them that an open internet is critically important to civil rights organizations. But you had to anticipate that. You had to know that the companies are coming after us. If you don't split the business interests, you're not going anywhere. So now you have to split the business interest. Then you have to get other constituents to really see, because the open internet just seems like something – it's just something that was already there. We're basically saying we want to codify what's already available to you. So the idea that there was this threat and somebody could change it, very difficult to do. So trying to understand like, well, if we don't get a bunch of constituencies to stand up with us and say that this is a concern, we're never getting – you know. And think about it. The FCC chair was Wheeler, who worked for the cable company. So we're basically saying I'm going to get Wheeler to turn his back on his best friends, and I'm going to get him – to actually say he's for something that he's publicly said he's against. And when you suddenly say that to yourself, you're like, and how am I going to get that done again? And unless you can say, well, this is how I see that crazy jujitsu happening, you're not getting it to happen. And that's what is important about a theory of influences. It's going to be really windy. You're going to have to play like crazy mind games, you know, and there's going to be a lot of shit thrown at you you're not even anticipating, but you better do as much as you can to anticipate it so that when it does come at you, it's not like the obvious stuff. Like anytime I do anything environmental, I know they're going to tell me that's going to kill jobs. So if I get killed the second I come out with the kill jobs thing and don't immediately have a message to get around it, then I'm being an idiot because I know that's coming at me.
Are there exercises you run through with your clients mm-hmm. to say like, okay, who are your biggest opponents? What are the strongest arguments against this? Why is this a bad idea?
Absolutely. And I also say to them like, you know, why do you think this is a good idea? When they tell me, well, it's polling results. You know, one of my favorite things recently was, like, definitely a majority of Americans do not like the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. They don't like it. At the same time, 56% of them wanted the Supreme Court to rule in favor of it. And you have to look at numbers like that all the time and be like, so they hate it, but they want to keep it. And, like, what does that mean? You know, and what does that mean when you say you can win? So in this case, people are winning because they're saying, you know what, once you give people a benefit, like, taking it away from them is almost impossible, so the inertia is in your favor and let's go. Great. But you have to think about that stuff. You have to
Sounds like a very mundane strategy for success. Inertia will win this campaign for us.
Inertia will win this campaign. Well, sometimes when inertia gets placed in the right – if it's in the right place, you know.
Yeah.
Like you go to the bathroom right now and have you ever noticed toilets? They make you – when they want you to use less water, they make you go up. But when you think about it, if they really wanted you mostly to use less water, they'd make you go down because that's your habit. That would be inertia in your favor, and that would be a much better communication thing. Down.
You're full of interesting anecdotes.
There you go.
In tech, they call that the tyranny of the default.
There you go.
You know, I think – I don't know if you heard about the local YMCA, the one –
Oh, that's going to close.
Yeah. They spent like some absurd amount of money, you know, I think tens of millions of dollars upgrading their facility. Because they did this internal – they could have really used you all maybe 5 years ago. They did these studies and they had this perception that their facility just didn't offer enough benefits to their members. So they spent millions, if not tens of millions, upgrading the facility and an increased membership like a fraction of a percent. And come to find out, really, it was just that people didn't know what they offered. And I feel like a lot of organizations we work with do the same thing where, you know, well-intentioned, but like they're spinning their wheels in the wrong place where they're almost hypercritical of their own performance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, personal perception and public perception are such two different things. How, you know, how do you work with organizations that maybe perceive themselves differently than you would say the public perceives
mm-hmm. them? You don't mean the general public, of course.
I don't know. Who's the general public?
Exactly.
Target audience groups.
No.
Do you,
such.
Actually, quick this is a second learner, position. This do you guy. Do like audience surveys or do you actually, what would be the term for this? Like
audience primary, analysis.
Yeah, primary analysis. Like,
Psychographic analysis. Profiling.
Psychographic. Yeah, that sounds really good. Let's go with that.
Will be for
that's right.
Your issue.
That's right. That's right. I think the most important thing for groups to figure out is to ask themselves the right question about their communication challenge. So it sounds to me in this case like the Y said, how can we get up our membership? And then they came up with some perhaps cockamamie ideas that in fact did not have the return on investment that they wanted.
Let's have 5 rock climbing walls or something ridiculous.
Right. But I think that that then is the wrong question, is like how to get up on our membership is to say, why is our membership low? Because then they would have asked people and they would have said, nobody knows about what we offer. Well, let's start with what we offer. So I think most organizations, it's very important that you understand how to figure out what your communication challenge is. So I'm seeing a lot of organizations right now because the Heritage Foundation posted their big report on opportunity, which is ironic if you ask me, on Medium instead of having a PDF. And everybody's all abuzz about this. This is like, oh my God, you know, have they killed the PDF? You know, and while that's exciting, I'm sure among communication nerds, the most interesting thing to me is that what basically Heritage is saying is that the reason people aren't consuming our report enough is that we haven't put it in the right format. Now, I don't know about you, but I can get myself around a PDF pretty easily. So if I wanted to read that report, I'd figure it out. I think the question is there any demand for that report before you actually issue it? Forget, you know, but their assumption is that their problem is where they're posting it.
Or maybe their metrics are how many people viewed the report versus who's viewing the report.
Right. So now, so before, I have no idea because we don't know what PDFs are, but I can look the other day and it was 383 have now looked at their opportunity report because they put it on Medium. Is that so much better? I don't know. But what I would just say is, like, make sure you're actually dealing with your communication challenge as opposed to, like, just doing after whiz bang things. I prefer it looks nicer on Medium. I like it. I probably would have read it the first time. But I get what they're saying. But if they're like, my communication challenge is actually that people are saying, I'd love to see your information, but it's not user-friendly enough. But I don't think that's what they – I don't think that's how they made that decision. I think they were just like, we want more eyeballs. Let's put it on Medium. But really the question is, how do we gin up demand for this actual report so people, wherever it is, go to find it? And so they're not necessarily asking the right question.
So other than hiring Spitfire, let's say you're running a small nonprofit and you've got a modest budget, what's an easy first step that you can take on your own to kind of get to the heart of that?
I think that's it, is really spending a lot of time, and it takes time. It's hard thinking. It's not easy, is to understand why aren't we engaging the people we need to engage? And like really setting up that problem. Because when you come up with the right problem, wasn't it Einstein who said, like, if somebody asked me to solve something, I'd spend, you know, 95% of the time coming up with the right question and then 5% solving it? Because that's it. Like, once, as soon as I say, this is the question, you'll come up with lots of answers. But they got to come up with the right question. So you really have to understand our communication challenge is what? Not enough people are engaging on this issue. Why is that? And like really trying to figure out that question that's going to get to your communication challenge will get you to spend your resources, whatever that is, whether it's time, money, both, better.
I thought you actually dropped a really powerful cognitive tool a few minutes ago that we kind of went right over, and that was almost the reversal of the question that you might think you're supposed to be asking. Like, we want to grow our audience. That's great, but once you answer that question, you should probably also answer, why haven't we grown our audience? And that might expose maybe some uncomfortable areas
yes.
in your organization.
Yes.
But, you know, just saying it out loud, like, that's probably the more valuable question of the two.
Yes.
Because you're going to find out what's prevented you from achieving what you're looking for.
Yes.
I don't know that that's such an easy question to answer, though. Or even if the question – it's not necessarily even that you're not – like you're avoiding the truth. It's like, you know, I think about, like, why don't I have like more clients who want to spend $1 million with me? And I'm like, I don't even know how to start. Like, I'm doing the best I can. It's not happening. Like, if I knew the answer.
But that's why that question's not a useful question. And I think that that is the point that both I and Brian are trying to make, is that a lot of times we're asking ourselves questions that don't lead you to useful answers. Like, you could be like, well, I could do these 15 things, but you still don't know. The question is, well, how many million-dollar clients are there out there that you're not getting? Oh, well, I know 15 RFPs that have been introduced that I wasn't on the list of. Well, okay, now you know what your market is. So now it's easier to say, well, how do I get in front of those 15? Mm-hmm. That's a much easier way to think about the influence you're going to need to exert to get in front of those 15. But I think a lot of us start too broad. Like, we're sort of like, I would like a lot of million-dollar clients. Why don't I have million-dollar clients? That's not that useful a question to actually help you understand where to spend your time and energy, in your case, on marketing your services.
Mm-hmm. And getting to the core of what that question is, I wouldn't know how to start, maybe. I'm really into, enforcing gun control legislation or something. And it's like, I know all about legislation. I know who I need to influence. But, like, why am I not being successful? Like that, I can't step back and see the forest for the trees.
Right. But you could say, well, we know it's been failing miserably in the last decade. Mm. Why has it failed? That's a great list to start with. Why has it failed? Is anything changed that suggests that it will not fail in the next time?
Mm-hmm.
Mass shootings do not actually seem to do anything, right? So has anything changed that says we're going to do this differently? Is there any different setup?
What would be the question for gun control advocates? Because that's a timely topic, speaking of attaching yourself to the news of the day. How would you talk to the Brady Group or someone like that?
I would ask them, what would make four people who are in power positions to change it, so on the right committee, what would make them commit to gun control? And most of the people are like, well, I have no idea. Well, until you have an idea, you're not changing gun control in this country. Mm-hmm. What would make them vote yes on gun control?
So in this case, it's a legislative strategy, and it's identifying the linchpin people who could potentially...
I'd say, these people currently are not supporting it. What would make them support it? And if you can't come up with an answer of, well, this would make them support it. And you could come up with crazy things, like a family member of theirs is in one of these attacks. Now it just became a lot more personal, right? To, you actually get anti-gun advocates to pay a lot of money into their PAC. Okay. But you have to come up with actual scenarios that you think would actually change their vote. Because if you can't, you know what their vote is. And they vote very consistently, or they won't bring things to the floor, or whatever's happening.
Are you an advocate for thinking big, like saying, like, our goal is eliminate guns? Or are you an advocate for saying, like, first thing we need to do is, like, tax bullets to make it just a little bit harder for people to, like, get ammunition?
I'm probably somewhere in between. I always want to keep my eye on what I'm going towards, mostly because I don't want to veer off and do short-term wins that actually move me further from my goal. I think sometimes people end up making compromises that then make it impossible for them to get where they want to go. But I am very much about actionable things. So I'm also not – I can't get rid of guns in one fell swoop. So I do want to know along the way, and I want to know the order in which it happens, because I do think things build a momentum, and if you don't put it in the right order, you actually get stuck. And so I think a lot of groups don't think about the order in which they're trying to get change.
And how does your expertise at Pool inform some of your views on this topic? Did you hang out at Buffalo Billiards a lot?
I have hung out at Buffalo Billiards a fair amount.
In the late 90s?
My across-the-street neighbor had a pool table as I was growing up, so I've been around a lot of pool tables, I'm not going to lie. And I think it's good, because I think one is that you sort of get the table you're dealt with, right? So somebody hits the ball, and then suddenly that's your table. Maybe you don't even know, were you stripes or salads? Like, you probably barely got to pick that. But, like, this is the game. This is the game you get to play. Not the game you wish you got to play, but this is the game you get to play. So figure it out, and go do your best game. But I think a lot of people just start shooting balls, not thinking about where their leave is. Are they guarding pockets? Are they leaving pockets open? They just don't do enough thinking at that broad level, and then they don't win.
Poignant.
Yeah, it's also kind of scary. I'm never going to bet against you. You just dropped way too much pool terminology.
Excellent. Well, then my job here is done.
Well, thank you for spending some time with us.
Of course.
One thing we do like to ask people to close out our podcast, if there are any nonprofits that they'd like to give a shout out to that deserve a little love. Anybody you can think of offhand?
Yeah. I'm giving my shout out to the Alaska Wilderness League. They have been fighting the good fight on two fronts. They are trying to get the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge permanently protected. And they're doing a lot of very interesting social media around that under We Are the Arctic campaign. And they also were a huge proponent of getting Shell out of the Arctic Ocean and drilling. And so they just did that. Awesome. They were part of the Shell No and the Highway to Shell efforts. And I just have to say that I think they've done creative stuff to protect one of our most pristine areas in America. And I'm very proud of them.
Okay. Brian, anything? Are we good here?
Thanks for being our first wine guest. And thanks for, giving it. I think this actually might now be my favorite podcast. And I challenge Colleen to
all the guests. I was going to say, I feel like I'm going to have to listen after this.
I challenge Colleen to come back and top this with all her new new expertise. But no, I think it's really valuable because these are some really big questions that. We've done some podcasts that are very specific to either person and organization, but what we've talked about today applies to every organization, regardless of issue. Unless you're not mission driven, but I don't think we deal with anybody who doesn't have some mission.
Salut, Jean-Pierre.
Salut.
Cheers.